Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Mueller, the special prosecutor, made very clear that he couldn't reach a determination on obstruction of justice, basically because of certain Justice Department guidelines, which didn't allow him to do that, but that he laid it out for Congress to do, not for the Attorney General to arrogate to himself the power to do it.
Bipartisan members of Congress made it clear that they had lost confidence in Director Comey. And most importantly, the rank and file of the FBI had lost confidence in their director.
They're having a good day. I'm having a good day, too. It was called No Collusion, No Obstruction.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan and I am tired. This finals week sucks. I'm sick on Jolt Cola and Marlboro Reds. Or actually, someone said it should be Red Bull and Juul to keep up with the youngs. So anyway, I'm sick on Red Bull and Juul, whatever that is, from staying up all night reading this damn Mueller report. On the other hand, I can't stop laughing at Guccifer II's prose style. I mean, it's in the report, and that guy, Guccifer, is kind of a genius of the language. So before my guest, Jed Sugarman, comes on to discuss the serious details and consequences of the Mueller report and Barr's failed effort to misleadingly frame it, I'm going to do something totally trivial, my Guccifer II impression. No Russian accent, though, since it's just texts. I know you're all disappointed. Anyway, here's my Guccifer. Hi there. Do you want some dirt on bloodust sadist Hillary? If you do, write back. It is utmost pleasure to serve beloved boss 55th birthday. Also, this will be so fun. Grab her by the pussy. She is neolib sadist. Thank you, Julian. You are hot. Okay. No one does it better than I do. My Guccifer impression. Joining me on the line is Slate favorite Jed Sugarman. He's a professor at Fordham Law School. He's a Yale JD and he's got a PhD in history. He writes frequently for Slate on legal matters. I'll be back with Jed in just a minute. But first, we have a new sponsor on TrumpCast today. It's a pharmaceutical brand that might be of interest to one listener in particular.
It's more common than you might think. Lady Justice is looking good. She's coming at you fast. You feel that old guilt start to rise, but you can't do anything about it. Many men over the age of 50 experience obstructile dysfunction. OD is a condition where men find it hard to obstruct justice because the people under them simply won't follow orders. Have you been in a situation where you had every intention to commit obstruction, but no one was willing to go to jail for you? Maybe it's time you ask your doctor about obstruxia. Obstruxia is a drug that inspires loyalty and blinds attorneys and advisors to the risks you're asking them to undertake. If you've experienced more than 10 episodes of attempted obstruction, obstruxia might be right for you. Before you know it, you'll be actually affecting the investigation instead of ranting and raving about wanting a Roy Cohn in your life. Obstruxia. Isn't it time you turned your hostile intent into actual prosecutable action? Obstruxia is not for everyone. Some patients reported everyone around them going to jail. Certain men under 50 might be too dumb to obstruct. Ask your doctor if your conscience is flawed enough for criminal activity. Call your physician if an obstruction lasts longer than 4 hours.
Jed, welcome back to TrumpCast.
Thank you for having me back, Virginia.
Before we get into the details, I want just a little context for yesterday. Yesterday, the beginning was the thing we're used to in Trump times, which was a spectacle, a press conference call. We all had to tune in as if for the moon landing to see Barr knew what most of us knew he would do, which is obfuscate and manipulate the information we were about to get in the form of the Mueller report. Most of us had set our expectations low. I know I had. I actually deliberately did a process of, as I went to bed the night before, of thinking, this is not anything like Christmas morning. This is going to be a disappointment. This is going to be like the Barr letter or like the Kavanaugh confirmation. It's just about to happen and I need to relax into it. But then the second half of the day, or even more than a half, was spent reading this massive document. And those of us whose cortisol levels are spiked, whose attention spans have been hijacked by the news cycle poisoning, had to slow way, way down. And I have to just ask you straight up, did you finish it?
I finished it by some version of reading, skimming, and then going back to see what later on what other commentators spotted.
Yeah,
that was my and then going back and reading more closely the spots where I realized I had been redact lighted or something.
That was such a good point you made. Both of us did PhDs for what they're worth, and spent a long time reading in graduate school. And you had this great point because as readers, you feel like a burden has been lifted when you come across a black page you don't have to read.
That's exactly right. I think people who spend a lot of time reading big documents in short periods of time, whether that's for a history or a humanities PhD or as lawyers.
Yes.
We all get trained to try and figure out what to read closely and what to skim. And this had the warped effect of going and seeing so many blacked out pages. I mean, on the one hand, my first reaction yesterday, I said this to Dahlia Lithwick, and I said, oh, this was less redacted than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also part of the gaslighting or part of the Barr expectation setting.
Yeah.
He talked about redaction so much that I think we were all conditioned to expect a lot of redactions. And then the problem is then when you get those redactions on this point, you get trained in the rest of your life to say, oh, this writer helped me by showing me what to skip.
This is
less relevant than other stuff. And my brain just did that automatically as I processed it because it was blacked out.
But in fact, it might be more important.
Well, that's exactly, it is obviously. I mean, that, and precisely now that I've had a chance to go back and reread between the things that I, where there are hints that I and other people sort of picked up on that are not blacked out. Then I go back, when I went back this morning to go back and check it, I'm now struck by how much significant stuff might be under those redactions.
Okay, so you said something to me in DMs that I'm going to make public without your permission, which is you were feeling yesterday critical of Robert Mueller. I mean, that has almost been heresy till now, since we've made him our great hope all this time, and with so much ink spilled about his integrity and his conscientiousness and his military discipline. But it wasn't just Barr who to some extent disappointed us yesterday. There was something even in the report, the things it left out, the refusal to commit to further indictments, the general conservatism of it that was frustrating.
Yes, let's go there.
Okay.
Let's talk about Robert Mueller, maybe small C conservative and maybe big C conservative. Now, just yesterday, I was talking to Dahlia and I said, I want to defend something by Mueller first. I think there's a lot of second guessing about not getting live testimony from Donald Trump. And I think that still we have to put that in context. It would have delayed things. Who knows how that might have triggered. We now know from this actual document on obstruction that Trump already did try to fire him once. So let me set that. I want to say that I still think there are many choices that are, I think, understandable and hard to question in hindsight. But let me highlight some things that I think are troubling about the way that Mueller handled both the Russian contacts question and the obstruction question.
So
Volumes one and two.
Okay.
Let me highlight on the Russian question. I think that there were spots where the questions were understated and buried And also, there was a lack of clarity from the beginning about what standard Mueller was using. Let me emphasize that at the very end of the document, at the end of volume one, when Team Mueller has to come back and decide about whether to indict on several key moments, like the June Trump Tower meeting and other kinds of key potential conspiratorial moments, mm-hmm. the team uses that the standard of proving it beyond a reasonable doubt. They use it 10 times. Mm-hmm. But here's my concern. They used it 10 times about specific questions, and I'm really surprised that when they wrote these documents, they didn't highlight their legal standards at the place where when you read a Supreme Court opinion or a Court of Appeals opinion or legal documents, the writers explain what their legal standard is from the beginning. And I think it's easy to lose sight because of how, frankly, this is a mistake in the way mm-hmm. this is written. By not stating clearly from the outset, which what I think is implicit at the end, that Team Mueller used a standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, mm-hmm. that first of all doesn't set this report clearly to the public about the fact that they were using a high standard for a criminal prosecution, and it's the correct. Let me say, I think that's also right. I think more prosecutors should take into account the importance of not indicting people unless they think that there's sufficient evidence to get a conviction. Mm-hmm. But what this does for the public is that it is confusing about when, you know, it also allows Barr to say in his letter, the special counsel's office did not establish a criminal conspiracy with Russia. That gave Barr enough room to use that phrase did not establish without mm-hmm. articulating what the standard was. And mm-hmm. I actually think that that Mueller's team in some ways accidentally enabled Barr to do that and wrote this report unclearly from that point. That's one big picture point.
Yep.
Second big picture point. I think that it was an error to use that language about not establishing when I think that the evidence they showed in the Russia report does establish by another standard, by a preponderance of the evidence, mm-hmm. that there was a criminal conspiracy involving Donald Trump himself. So mm-hmm. again, I understand why they didn't indict. But when you're writing a document, and I think many people have talked about that this document has different audiences, a document about whether to indict, but also a document explicitly addressed to Congress. Mm-hmm. The team should have looked at what we now know were a series of events that in context show that Trump was essentially soliciting a foreign campaign contribution mm-hmm. and was arguably soliciting hacking in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. Right. So part of this is also, and I don't want to overuse this phrase gaslighting, but I think it's a different thing. I think there's a cognitive dissonance. When you hear the word conspiracy, you expect it to be behind the scenes, caught on tape in the Oval Office, right? Yeah. And then revealed after investigation. In context with this report, plus what we already saw with their own eyes, when Trump gets up and says, Russia, if you're listening, mm-hmm. go find Hillary's emails. Mm-hmm. That was, first of all, you know, it was dissonant to see that in broad daylight. But I want to highlight how this report gives us more context about why that really was potentially a criminal conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And specifically, what we see in volume two, let me dig down just a little bit on this question.
Please.
In volume two, on page 18, there is a discussion.
Does everyone have their hymnals open?
We'll pause. If you're playing at home, you can go to your PDF, you can search for this passage. But first of all, half of it's blacked out.
Yep.
But several people have highlighted, first of all, that Trump says that he knew that there were upcoming leaks coming from WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one point. Marcy Wheeler has also suggested that this passage helps us see that in the Stone indictment, there was this phrase that a senior campaign official, quote, was directed to reach out to Stone about about upcoming WikiLeaks. And that all happens around this time. So just this period of time is July 22nd, there's a massive WikiLeaks dump.
Yep.
5 days later, Trump gets up and says, Russia, if you're listening, it appears from what's not redacted that in this time frame, Trump knows that there is more coming from WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
OK, so the one question is, did Trump know this from public bragging by Julian Assange? Maybe, but it's not just any bragging. It would have to have been bragging in this very short window. And I haven't done this research, but it would have to be between July 22nd and July 27th. Otherwise, one is left to wonder if this is why this is Trump who asked Manafort to be in touch with Stone, to be in touch with Assange.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me be clear. Right? That is, if that is what happened, and if this is under black redaction, that this is what happened, this is at least sufficient, probable cause that that Trump was engaging in back channels, back and forth with conduits to coordinate the release of material, and then to go up in front of cameras and give speeches about this. It's crazy that he did it.
Mm-hmm.
It's dissonant that we saw it, but it is exactly the time frame that is about Russian contacts. And so one other thing to mention is this also ties back to the Trump Tower meeting in June.
Yeah.
We don't need a smoking gun or a text message to tell us that when Don Jr. sets up that meeting, where he's told he's going to get dirt, and he says, if this is what you say it is, I love it.
Yep.
And an hour later from that meeting being set up, Trump gives a speech saying, I'm going to give a big speech next week about Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
With all of that context, I think that Robert Mueller's report should have connected those dots, and instead it should have been in the executive summary. That should have been an executive summary to lay that out, and they failed to do that. Now, one more caveat, Virginia.
Please.
In volume one, pages 51 to 56, much of those pages are completely are mostly redacted. Mm-hmm. Some of those pages are almost completely redacted. So at least to give Mueller a little bit more latitude, maybe we should wait to find out either what's on those precise pages about WikiLeaks and Roger Stone. It's understandable that they may have been redacted given what we know about the harm to matters under investigation. Mm-hmm. And we also should wait for Mueller to be subpoenaed and to testify. But I think at this stage, I think that was an error. So that's part of my concern about what Mueller didn't do in the Russia volume.
So this is the when you mention these redacted passages, they're mostly the phrase that we now know. It's like in Watergate times, expletive deleted was the phrase on everybody's lips. But now the phrase is HOM, harm to ongoing matter, which I think was trending as a term yesterday. So the passages you're talking about, just let me understand, the reason they're redacted is that they to reveal it would be to reveal part of an ongoing investigation rather than, say, damage to Trump's reputation or grand jury testimony or some of the other reasons that things are redacted.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think if we had to separate of the four reasons we know.
Yeah.
Two of them are we should give a lot of credibility. We should treat as valid.
Yeah.
When they're redacted for harm to ongoing matter or for protecting sources and methods. Those two reasons, and that's a lot of what is redacted.
Yes, it is.
I think it's valid to say I'm reluctant to say this, but I think we should give Barr the benefit of the doubt at this stage on those redactions. I have more concerns about the redacting for grand jury because Barr could have gone to if Barr I think was doing his job, he would have asked for those to, you know, if Mueller put that in his report. And then he was comfortable with making it public. I think and the other thing that I think is dubious is the reputational kinds of concerns.
But I don't think he cited that. I think in the end he agreed not to use that kind of redaction. But, you know, I agree with you that unless proven otherwise, the redactions seem on the up and up. But I also agree with you that whatever's under those redactions, the conclusions, what could have been in the executive summaries that you point out, don't quite seem to track. I mean, it's very unlikely that what's under the redactions is exonerating, but it does seem like there must be a line or two to justify the conclusions. You know,
That's right.
It's like a geometric proof where you're missing a couple of lines or something and the end doesn't quite add up.
Absolutely. And if you wanted to summarize them and you knew that they might be redacted, I think that the executive summaries should have been written in a way that would have made the redaction completely ridiculous, right? You could still, it's a report about Trump. You could describe circumstances in executive summary, lining up the story I just laid out, that you know, that narrative of basically that narrative is Trump having sufficient reason to know that WikiLeaks was connected to Russia hacking because of the Trump Tower, because of the June meeting, and because of what's already in Mueller's indictments. Mueller's indictments in the criminal information lay out a timeline where Trump says X, and then Russian hackers immediately afterwards do Y, and then DC Leaks drops what they hacked. You don't have to mention Roger Stone to summarize, or anything Roger Stone said, or anything in a grand jury to summarize that basic conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And other people, I mean, you most studiously, but also, as you say, Marcy Wheeler and Parker Malloy have pointed out that the WikiLeaks part of this in some ways is most concerning, because we know, and we knew going in, that a conversation between Donald Trump or Paul Manafort and Prigozhin at the IRA was unlikely to have happened. You know, something about how you're going to seed various memes. I mean, they'd been, IRA in particular had agents here since 2014, and it wasn't until 2016 that they were really gunning for Trump. So I don't think anybody saw the IRA indictments and said, well, you know, one thing we know is that Mike Flynn was always in close touch with Putin's chef running, you know, the IRA.
Right.
So that's one thing. And then as for a GRU conversation, so this is Russian military intelligence, it also seemed unlikely that Don Jr. was talking to the highest levels of the FSB or the GRU and sorting out exactly from the beginning in advance how to hack both the DNC and the RNC. We have to remember they hacked both of them, but only released the results of the DNC hacks. So it comes down to the publication, right, of this stuff. There were other efforts to solicit hacking. Well, I should say, Guccifer, right, is Guccifer considered a publishing force or a kind of persona, you know, they said? Or is he himself doing the hacking, or does it matter? And well, I think this is the question too for Julian Assange, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this also raises, I think, going back to the legal standard, I think all the questions you're asking are why a prosecutor would wisely not bring an indictment, because I think there is some gray area about the legal definitions of these different entities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's also enough reasonable doubt about, you know, the facts and maybe the mental element of what was going on here. But that's very different from writing a report for Congress and the public.
Yeah.
When this is about, you know, we talked, the last time we talked, you and I, for the podcast, we talked about how Mueller seems to be writing not just a prosecutorial document, but also a counterintelligence document.
Yes.
I think there's some audience confusion in this document, because it is often written as if it were a counterintelligence document about Russia. But then when it comes to evidence sufficient to establish X or Y, it uses the criminal prosecution standard. And I think that's we would not want our national security apparatus to only act if they're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. We want them to act because things are likely.
I remember the dread Colin Powell saying, you act when you have between 30% and 60% of the information. It's very far from beyond a reasonable doubt, which would be something like 95% if you could put a number on it.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what he said is, if you have 30% of the information, and please, listeners, Jed, don't think about WMDs here, but if you have only 30%, of information. I mean, if you have 30% of information, you know, that's enough. If you have less, it's too little. But if you have 60, if you have more than 60, you've waited too long. And with national security, you know, I mean, it's more like medicine than like a courtroom. You don't want the patient to die. And so if there's a decent chance that there's a cancer there, you proceed as if there is. And that, I think, you're really right to point out and clarify for me anyway, the difference between a CI investigation and a criminal investigation. At the same time, the 95% beyond a reasonable doubt, whatever it is, standard is a weird one to talk about for indictments, right? Like if I have plenty of circumstantial evidence that someone's dealing heroin, I can get a subpoena for a warrant. I can indict. I'm not convicting. Of course, you're not convicting on a standard below reasonable doubt. But that's preponderance of the evidence, right?
Yes, but okay. So that's right.
Explain this to me, because this is hard for me.
So this is, and I've spent a lot of time trying to think through this about what is the right standard, because I also am troubled about the mismatch. I personally feel about mass incarceration on the one hand and prosecutorial overreaching in our system generally, and then what we have in our white collar world after, you know, the 2008 Great Recession, where no one gets indicted, right?
Yes.
One person who had nothing to really do with that episode during the Obama administration. So, but let me take a step back. I think it's important that I'm not saying that you can only indict if you know that you've got proof beyond a reasonable doubt at 95%. Yes. But I also think it's a mistake to say that whenever a prosecutor thinks that there's probable cause, they should always indict or recommend indictments. That number that you gave between of Colin Powell between 30 and 60 about acting, that's sort of that's a window around, you know, more likely than not. Then I think there's also a window for prosecutors. They shouldn't be acting, they shouldn't be indicting people and overcharging just when they get to 51%. So that window is something like, let's say, a jury convicts at 95%. Prosecutors should be anticipating that once they, you know, if they're able to then get more evidence, they could get to 95, but they've got to be starting around 70 to 80. They can get an indictment at 51, but should they? They can get a warrant at 51, but a warrant is not putting someone into a grinder of our legal system. So I wish we had a more consistent approach across crimes. I wish that with mass incarceration, prosecutor with everyday people, that prosecutors had this ethical stance. I'm concerned they don't. I'm concerned with white collar crime. Prosecutors take into account that with the best lawyers on the opposite side, they're fearful of losing. This is the Jesse Eisinger's great book about Comey himself in the Southern District, the Chicken Shit Club. About the reluctance to bring white collar crimes. I think in this case that window is fair. The stakes are too high to just bring an indictment against the president of the United States. So let me, that's a segue to the obstruction question.
Yeah, please. Yes, I was thinking about that. Parenthetically, I was thinking about Comey's book where he says, they brought the Martha Stewart case, unlike the ones they avoided like chicken shits, because they had evidence of her lying, not the, you know, malfeasance and stock shenanigans themselves, but the lying. And that brings us to obstruction.
If I recall correctly, Martha Stewart was indicted for obstruction even without any evidence of an underlying crime.
Yes, yes.
So let's just, okay, let's pause there. This entire idea that Barr has presented that shapes the Mueller report is that you don't bring an obstruction indictment unless you find evidence of an underlying crime is wrong. And Martha Stewart's case, Martha Stewart might have something to say about that in her experience. So it's actually the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. It's the fact that it's not that the lack of underlying crime means that there's no obstruction. It goes the other way. It's the facts of obstruction mean you can't really say much with confidence about whether or not there was an underlying crime. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But before we get to obstruction, I do want to highlight one other error. I think that Mueller understates the evidence that he shows the world about Manafort and Gates and what they knew about Kilimnik.
Yes,
Let me just highlight this. It's really important. What we now see in this report is that Manafort and Gates knew that Kilimnik was a Russian spy. Gates tells Manafort. It's not just that Kilimnik is connected to Deripaska and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. The report tells us that Gates tells Manafort, come on, dude, Kilimnik's a Russian spy. That's a paraphrase.
And Gates was also a supremely good cooperating witness with Mueller. So there's no doubt that when he gives up a lot. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I mean, let's pause there for a second. Mueller is right to understand the challenges of relying on Gates for an indictment. We know that in Manafort's trial in the Eastern District of Virginia, when the jury talked afterward, they had doubts about Gates. Without corroborating testimony from others, it's very hard to rely on Gates himself. I can understand why you wouldn't want to bring a criminal prosecution based solely on Gates' testimony. I think that's reasonable. But on the specific question about whether Kilimnik was a Russian spy, you don't need 12 witnesses to tell you that this guy is connected. A former, one just simply has to look up Kilimnik's background to show you that that's not a tremendous leap from the facts. But here's the key detail that we learn in this report. We learned that Gates and Manafort were regularly giving Kilimnik internal polling data, not just sharing the CNN big poll. They were sharing internal polling data for months with Kilimnik. And then on August 2nd, we know in this report that Manafort gives Kilimnik 70-something pages, including not just internal polling, but identifying Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota as the target states.
Trip wires for anyone who lived through the 2016 election, because, of course, three of the four of those states decided the election for
and
Trump.
And Minnesota was closer than it ever was before.
Yeah.
Now, so here's where I have concerns about the way that Mueller wrote this report. Mueller then goes into detail about that Manafort Gates, about their motives. And he says, well, they might have been motivated by the campaign, or they might have been motivated by getting in the good graces with Deripaska, but given that there were legal issues, et cetera. How are those two things different? Right. How do you get in the?
Yeah.
Was the polling data showing that Manafort was a really good pollster, or that he was good at creating graphics? The point of sharing the internal polls with Kilimnik was related to the campaign and to show that the campaign was close. And it would have been at least maybe not beyond a reasonable doubt, but certainly beyond probable cause that if you knew that Kilimnik was a spy, and if you knew that all around the summer of 2016 that Russians were, you'd been in a meeting in Trump Tower with Russians telling you that they had dirt, right?
Yeah.
And then you give them polling data and identifying which target states might be important. I mean, come on, that might not be beyond a reasonable doubt. But that is enough to highlight to not include the sentence that they could not establish that there was a conspiracy between Trump campaign officials and Russia. Again, just like you said before, you don't need Manafort to have a one-on-one meeting with Putin to establish a conspiracy. There are cutouts, there are go-betweens, and a conspiracy often works with indirect contacts. I think that moment, Mueller should have framed it and put it in the executive summary as something to identify for Congress, right? To make the public see that, as opposed to trying to find that on page 155 around all these other redactions.
There are certain, and I wonder about this, and I don't want to break your stride, but there are certain moments where you can almost imagine a conflict in OSC, and there's some other evidence that there might be some conflict there, where there's a discussion about, can we say Kilimnik is a spy? Well, in English and American common law, you have to be very careful about saying that. But in common parlance, we always hear once KGB, always KGB, that the oligarchs don't do anything without Putin, that Prigozhin, Putin's chef, is essentially an agent of the Russian government. But all those things, there's a certain decorousness to Mueller about making these calls that people, and you don't have to be Seth Abramson or Louise Mensch to connect these dots. These are the kinds of things that we've known about how Russia works all the time. I mean, anyway, and then the second great example of that is Michael Cohen saying in many places that he was directed to lie by Donald Trump, and then clarifying that before Congress to say he doesn't say, soldier, you now must lie, what Trump does is speak in some kind of code, like an extorter, you know, like this is the way it happened. Right, Mike? And, right. You know, and yet Mueller demurs there and will not consider that subornation of perjury because he's imagining a room of gentlemen where if you're asked to lie, it looks much more like Haldeman and Nixon talking, even though that had its own vagueness. But then it does, you know, like Sammy the Bull Gravano talking, like, it, you know, so I think that's very interesting, too, that I sort of can imagine some of the lawyers in the room. And if you think about the people who talk to BuzzFeed, their sources, they purport to be close to OSC. I've seen nothing to suggest that they're not. But they say that they're with Cohen, that this was being directed to lie, where other people who've worked less with the mob or who, you know, who have a different standard for that will refuse to call that subornation of perjury. And I just think that's very interesting that there are these kind of competing idioms. You know, it's almost like Revolutionary War soldiers wanting to sort of behave with certain standards of or you know, English soldiers fighting a jungle army that, you know, wait, but we fight, we don't eat our dogs and we don't, and we tend to the battle wounded on the other side. And we, you know, and, right. And then the Trump types are just like, what are you talking about? We, didn't he say something like fuck shit up or like, you know, make shit happen. Like he's just playing a very different game and talking in this thuggy way. And anyway, I feel that conflict in the report. And you feel Mueller doing what you say, being conservative, at least conservative, small c. Yes. I'm not going to call that a crime because we didn't hear Manafort say to Putin himself, let's conspire.
Yes. And there are other legal commentators. There's a Paul Seamus Ryan also said that Mueller kind of got described coordination under campaign finance law incorrectly. And you don't need either an explicit or an implicit agreement for something to be coordinated. In fact, if you required that, Congress said that that would be giving too much of a loophole for people to get out from under coordination. It can be loosely coordinated by context and not by implicit or explicit agreement. So that seems to be a mistake, too, given that the campaign finance questions are part of this criminal conspiracy.
Yeah.
Right? Soliciting a foreign. Let me also say, I agree with the Mueller conclusion that simply meeting foreign officials or foreigners and having conversations with them, that cannot be criminal. Right. We cannot call that. Receiving something of value is simply talking to or meeting with Veselnitskaya, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it is very important that we acknowledge that we shouldn't turn campaign finance law into something that would put a chilling effect on the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think it's important to distinguish between that correct interpretation of campaign finance law and what seems to be an incorrect interpretation of campaign finance law when there is when there's coordination not requiring requiring such an agreement. And I think that's what I was talking about before.
Conspiracy and RICOs are by nature, I think conspiracy means whisper together, that these are not handshake contract deals. And for the prosecutors in the room, in the special counsel's office, who were accustomed to dealing with the mafia. I mean, I don't know. What I keep thinking about with Mueller is that he turned the FBI into a counterintelligence operation after 9/11, and that he's probably still fighting the last war. It's just human nature. And counterintelligence probably interests him more than the criminal stuff. And he's used to thinking about the really complex operation of trying to find terrorist organizations that work in cells, as opposed to mafia thugs who hide in plain sight. And that this thing is so brain scrambling that I honestly don't blame one brain, Robert Mueller's, for being unable to get every part of it. But I do hold out hope that the counterintelligence investigation, much of which is redacted here, some of which just isn't here at all, or isn't even hinted at here, will still, in the hands of the FBI, pull off more indictments.
I think that's right. I mean, just one quick thing. When you said conspire and whisper together, it popped into my head, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I just quickly looked it up because I thought spire, also like respirate, and that's right.
Yes.
It's actually to breathe together.
Yes, to breathe together.
It's not even to whisper. The origin of the word conspiracy is to coordinate, even if it's by just body language. The literal body language of breathing is enough to be etymologically a conspiracy.
That's amazing. And that is also very much what Michael Cohen, and I still hold on to, Mr. Trump speaks in code, and I understand that code.
Yes. They've been breathing together for so many years.
Yes.
And wasn't there a passage, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there a passage where Trump says to one of his lawyers in the obstruction side, maybe it was to McGahn, "Oh, I've never had a lawyer take notes before." I think it may have been Jamal Green at Columbia who may have said this, who said, "This is the most damning sentence in the entire report." and that is dead on.
Yes.
It speaks volumes, or it breathes volumes, about how Trump doesn't get nailed for crimes over the course of his career. And again, here, he makes sure that his lawyers don't take notes. He doesn't text. He doesn't email.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just a master at surrounding himself with people who will follow his breathing and body language.
Yeah.
But on obstruction, let me say that this is both how Barr, I think, mischaracterized the obstruction and also how Mueller sets up that this mischaracterization. And this is also about Mueller being a big C conservative in terms of executive power.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are so many episodes in the obstruction volume that are that I think are pretty damning.
Yeah.
And if Mueller should have written a sentence like, "But for the OLC policy, right, or of not indicting a sitting president," there was sufficient evidence here there to indict for obstruction of justice. I mean, I just think when you look at these events, whether it was firing Comey, trying to fire Mueller himself, and in context, what seemed to be pardon dangles, it seems like Mueller. I understand why Mueller concluded. I'm not begrudging. Let me be clear. I think that Mueller probably made the right decision here not to call for an indictment. But I think that this was not written clearly enough to say that this was probably criminal. I think it's explicit that Mueller is inviting Congress. I think he talks about, he talks about the separation of powers and Congress's role.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the report should have been clearer about how this constitutes legal obstruction. And maybe he did. Maybe when you read the report in totality, that's the message he conveys. But I think it should have been written more explicitly in the summaries.
Yes, it was such a Rorschach that it was just manfully, aggressively misinterpreted and spun by Barr in the introduction. So his remarks, he said, I think in response to a question, he said in no uncertain terms, when asked whether it was Justice Department regs that he thinks stopped Mueller from making an indictment on obstruction. And he, said something, I can't quote it exactly, but it was like, mark my words, no, it was on the merits or on the non-merits of the obstruction case that he decided not to indict. And that, the fact that that was so important to Barr that he could obfuscate there, because there are instances in the report that suggest that the regulations were very much on Mueller's mind and that his sense of broad executive powers. And God bless him. We've had everybody's least favorite poltergeist, Ross Garber, on this show, the impeachment defense attorney, who I think from private conversations is politically liberal. But because he just has, someone has to have their eye out for the executive branch itself.
Right.
And
can we just pause and give a shout out to Ross Garber out there? I think we love Ross.
He keeps us on our toes. And he, I always call him a buzzkill because he loves when everybody's zealously gunning to, show that the report should take Trump out tomorrow. He always brings in some measured, not really. He's immensely interesting. And I think he clarifies the thinking of lots of other people who might overreach or might not understand the long-term importance of those pillars, towers, I think of Notre Dame, that of the executive branch that still need to stand even after its desecration by Donald Trump. And
absolutely.
Donald Trump would persuade us that, l'état c'est moi, to say Donald Trump, but it is not. And there is an office of the presidency that needs to outlast him. And so that, I think, is important. And that may have been on Mueller's mind when he didn't indict. But what made me mad is Barr saying, no, he didn't indict because Trump didn't obstruct justice, conclusively didn't obstruct justice. And that just played right into Trump's hands and I think was really malfeasance on Barr's part.
I think that's all right. And I also want to just add that, you know, it's important for people to keep us on our toes and keep us in check. I think Ross does that. And I also think a lot of people have made good arguments pushing back about how to the risks of criminalizing regular government business, you know, criminalizing president doing things that are covered by Article 2. But it's important that Mueller did not adopt that view that Barr expressed in his memo. I mean, to give Mueller credit on the law, and I think that this was Mueller answering maybe that memo by saying, you know, Congress has a role to keep the executive branch, including the president, from obstructing justice. And so I think what's challenging here is that Mueller says that, but then is unwilling to actually make those conclusions when presented with the facts, right? I think he's right on the law. Mm-hmm. I think he's also right that on the law and the politics of indicting a sitting president, I think he made that right choice. But why is it that for example, in the report on page 101, 102, mm-hmm. there's this information about on the obstruction material. We know that that Trump Jr. lied about the meeting, about the Trump Tower meeting. And there's information here where the president participated, right? And we know, in fact, that the president's lawyers told Mueller in a previous document that Trump participated in telling Don Jr. to lie about what the Trump Tower meeting was about.
I don't mean to give the last word to myself, but I do want to tell you some breaking news on Twitter. Justin Miller, the national editor of the Daily Beast, tweeted, "Impeachment is embedded in Mueller's report. He's not the first person to say this. Mueller's point is we, the prosecutor's office, can't accuse Trump of crimes because OLC memo forbids indictment." And then the report says, and this part's verbatim, "Only the House of Representatives, quote, has the authority to bring charges of criminal misconduct through impeachment," right? So he says this is an impeachment referral, if not an indictment. And guess who comes in and says, "This is true. Volume 2 is plainly an impeachment referral." Ross Garber. So I'm going to forward you that tweet.
Please and do.
We're going to look forward to volumes 3 to 20 of this report, which hopefully will happen in Congress and an impeachment.
I'm going to go the other way. I think it's too soon to impeach. I think that just we're talking about prosecutorial discretion and being wise. I think we want to hear from Mueller live. We want the tax. We want subpoenas for the tax records and Deutsche Bank. I think that there is more to unredact before the House moves forward with impeachment. Now, I think it goes the other way.
Who wants to agree on everything? I am glad to hear you say that. Jed Sugarman is a professor at Fordham Law School with a Yale JD and PhD. He writes frequently for Slate on legal matters. Thanks very much for being here, Jed.
Thank you, Virginia.
And that's it for today's show. Tell us what you think. Let's make some Twitter threads together. I'm Paige 88. The show is at Real Trumpcast. Ross Garber, if you want to weigh in, I'm all ears. And before we go, I highly encourage you to sign up for Slate Plus. Today's the day. It's a mere $35 for the first year. That's highly competitive pricing for top quality content. Go to slate.com/TrumpcastPlus. That's slate.com/TrumpcastPlus. Our show today was produced by Melissa Kaplan with help from Barrett Jacob. Everybody needs a nap today. Steve Waltine performed today's sketch. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.